Okay, let's start. Well, we don't have an awful lot of time left in the semester. And in the old days, I used to use the last week for review. But now the administration, in its deep wisdom, has said I shouldn't even have classes in the last week. So nobody seems to mind that terribly. Professors manage to put up with it somehow or other, not having to do this extra work. Though I have to say, I miss hearing, it sounds awful to say it, but I can feel Philosophy 138 forming in my throat when it gets to be this time of day on a Tuesday or a Thursday. So I won't miss lecturing. But in any case, we only have four more sessions counting this one, the way I look at the calendar. Now, when are your papers due? Well, I think we might as well make it due the last official day of the term, which would be December 8th. Is that all right? Can you bear that, having to put it off till that time? And then I have to look on the university calendar and announce when the final exam is. I don't know the exact time of that, but it's easy enough to find out. And it's the only university rule that I know firmly, and that is I'm required by the Academic Senate to announce in class when the final exam will be. So I will announce that. That's both a prediction and a promise. You had your hand up.
Yeah, December 8th is
what?
It's dead week,
right.
Last day.
The last day of class, when classes are scheduled, is Thursday, December 8th. Now, I'm perfectly willing to say you should hand them in the last day of de facto class, which would be December 1st. But I thought I might give you another week. Can you bear it? I mean, there's massive objection to having an extra week. I can do it on the last day of the actual class. But the class scheduled ends on December 8th. It's just that the week that includes December 6th and 8th is supposed to be for R&R. I'm not sure what they stand for, but rest and rehabilitation or something like that. Whereas I said, in the old days, you would all go to Rio. Now you have to go to Bangkok for reasons that I don't want to have to explain to you. But there was a time when you would go to Tangier, but that ended a long time ago. All right, so is that okay then? Let's say, this is tentative, but unless there's some reason not to, the papers will be due on the 8th. But since we won't be meeting in this room on the 8th, you'll have to hand them in to your GSI, Stephen or Jennifer, and that means you'll have to make arrangements with them, I assume, in 301 Moses or my office, which is 148 Moses. And topics are on on B-Space, at least as far as I know they are. I put them there. Did anybody find them there? Maybe nobody's looking for them this early. But in any case, I might even put some more on. I'm there because a lot of interesting things that are worth writing about that I did not have a chance to put on the list of topics. Okay, we're now at the part of the course where we're discussing applications of the theory that I gave you of social ontology to other philosophical problems. And the one that is most of concern to us right now is the nature of rights, and in particular human rights, and in particular so-called universal human rights. Are there such things? Now we have as a leitmotif going through several lectures the question of why socialism failed. And I think it's a fascinating question, and I have not seen a good book about it. But I'm going to keep interspersing things about it. Let me start with that. You remember I told you how when I was an undergraduate, we used to go to these evening sessions held by the leading socialist theorist of that era. I think he's probably utterly forgotten now, but don't worry about it. We'll all be forgotten eventually. Anyway, his name was G.D.H. Cole, and he was regarded as a great Marxist thinker, and he told us that the essence of socialism were these four features: public ownership of the means of production, together with no great wealth differences. You shouldn't have a situation that we now have in the United States where, they keep repeating to us over and over, the top 1% has a percentage of the wealth that vastly exceeds 20, I don't know what the figure is, don't quote me on this, but it's a hell of a lot of money they got. That's a technical term. You can write that in your notes. Okay, and now the other thing that Cole emphasized was no great class differences. Everybody ought to be able to meet everybody else on a basis of equality. And finally, the fourth point was everybody has to contribute. You shouldn't have a class of parasites. Now, I have to also tell you that as an American in England, there was a kind of religious atmosphere to these sessions where we all talked about the nature of socialism and how we're going to achieve it. And nobody asked, well, really, is socialism a good idea? It would be about like asking, is Christianity a good idea when you had a session in the Vatican? But the general flavor was, well, not what's the best way to educate people, but what is a socialist education? What would a socialist education be like? So there was a certain religious orthodoxy that pervaded these discussions, and I found that slightly offensive. But the beauty of being an undergraduate, you can try out everything. So it's true that on Wednesday nights, I went to the socialist discussion group, but on Thursday nights, I went to parties with a lot of conservative reactionaries. And the only law I can tell you about the difference between the reactionaries and the socialists is that the reactionaries tend to have better-looking girls at their parties than the socialists do. I have no idea if this holds over in other cultures, but it certainly held true in Oxford of that distant era. Okay, but it occurred to me, it isn't obvious that these are really desirable. Public ownership, well, it's kind of an empirical question for which institutions public ownership works better and which it doesn't, and it's often relative to a cultural background. So the German railways seem to me to work pretty well, although they're publicly owned. On the other hand, the British railways were pretty hopeless when they were publicly owned. The train schedule between London and Oxford when I was an undergraduate was worse than it had been at the time of the First World War. I mean, they just had been a steady decline. Now, whether or not it's better after privatization, that seems to me a factual point. So it's not obvious which institutions work better with public ownership and which with private ownership. In effect, all universities are publicly owned. They are nominally not, because the regents and the trustees of Stanford own Stanford, and the Harvard Board of Overseers owns Harvard. But in fact, it's simply not a public, it's not a private property institution. It is, if it tried to really go into business like a regular business, it would be in a lot of trouble. So it's not clear to me that this is really an ideological issue at all. If economics is an empirical discipline, then it ought to be a matter of investigation which institutions work best when they're in private hands and which institutions work best in public hands. I guess public parks and national parks, that's generally agreed that they work better when they're under a public control, ownership and control. But I don't think really that ought to be much of an ideological issue at all. But how about no great differences in wealth? Well, I think it's not a bad idea to allow people to get rich. The bad idea is if you allow huge fortunes to be passed through inheritance, because basically what is it gives families control of the country. If you have the amount of money that the Rockefellers have, you can effectively buy elections, and they do that in a number of states. And that, I think, is unhealthy. So the cure for that is not to prevent people from getting rich. I think it's a great idea that they're all the filthy rich running around, and I don't feel disgusted when I go through and shake my head at the vulgarity of Beverly Hills and think if only they lived like associate professors, we'd all be much happier. I don't think that. I think it's perfectly all right. And a certain amount of vulgarity, I think, is probably not unhealthy. The real problem is vast quantities of inherited wealth, and then you do get serious problems because you get control of the society which is not based in any sense on merit. It's not a level playing field. When if the guy who puts himself through law school has to compete with the Kennedys for an unelected position in the state of Massachusetts, they have an enormous advantage. And their obvious defects didn't seem to hurt them very much. So, for example, Teddy Kennedy, in part at least, bribed his way through Harvard. He hired somebody to take his language exams for him and had various other defects that if you had been guilty of any of those, you would have been in a lot of trouble. So I think that is not, the point is not that there should be no great differences in wealth, but that inherited wealth is inherently dangerous. Now, if you get huge differences in actual incomes, in annual incomes, as apparently we have in the United States now, worse than at any time since 1928, I just don't know what the consequences of that are going to be. But it does make me nervous. Now, class differences is interesting because in America, we have huge wealth differences without an awful lot by way of class differences. If you're riding in a plane and you strike up a conversation with a guy in the seat next to you, by and large, Americans of any social class can converse with a guy in the next seat. They don't have a lot of trouble. A friend of mine was on a plane once. I don't know if I told you this story. We were all meeting. We were going to meet in Turkey and travel around the Mediterranean. And he was, at that time, the mayor of San Francisco. And he sat next to a woman, and they struck up this conversation. And she said to him, "Well, what do you do?" And he said correctly that he's in the restaurant business because Gavin owns a restaurant or two. And he's from San Francisco. And she said how much she loved San Francisco, but boy, did they ever have a kooky mayor. This is when he had come out in favor of authorizing gay marriage. Now, I would have found it irresistible to say, I'm the mayor. But he didn't say that. He said, yeah, they have a very unusual mayor in San Francisco. But anyway, he went on in this vein about that was a nice town, San Francisco, but they did suffer from having Gavin Newsom as mayor. But in any case, the point I'm trying to make here is, in general, Americans can meet each other and talk about the football scores or the state of the weather or the bad state of the economy pretty much on the basis of equality, where that was out of question in the England of my childhood. You knew immediately what everybody's class situation was and what things would have been, what sort of topics of conversation would have been appropriate or not appropriate. The point, however, is this does not seem to be a function of economics. You can have a society where a lot of people are rich and other people are not rich and still have more or less class equality. Okay, now this last one, everybody has to make a contribution. I think that's rather sinister. There's an element of fascism in that. Suppose I decide I'd like to take a year off and just hitchhike around or go hang out on the beach. What this says is you can't do that. You would then be a parasite. I don't think the government ought to be in the business of telling people what they ought to do with their time. And if I want to be a bum, provided, as they say, I don't break the law, then it seems to me perfectly legitimate. The hippie lifestyle is not something I would endorse, and many aspects of it, no doubt, are illegal. But I don't think it is a matter of public policy that they should be forbidden, that they should be clapped in jail on the grounds that they're not making their contribution to society. So I don't think that the socialist ideal was such a great ideal. I think if you treat economics as an empirical science, and you ask yourself, well, what is the best way to get the maximum benefit out of an economic system, then it looks to me like there's not an awful lot of room for ideological squabbling. It looks to me like it's a straightforward, factual economic matter, and we're now exhibiting the consequences of making several catastrophic mistakes in working that out. Most importantly, apparently, what we have now is a crisis of credit. People undertook a lot of debts, particularly housing debts, that they couldn't afford to pay, And this is playing itself out in the economy. All right, so now I'm going to go back and talk about human rights, but I just wanted to resume this discussion of socialism. I think socialism has lost its glamour. I don't think many of your generation are thrilled at the prospect of socialism in a way that when I was an undergraduate, it was I formed an ideal for a very large number of intellectuals. There was an ideal of socialism, and then there was a constant challenge, I don't know a better word for it, of Marxism. And the idea was, well, if you accept socialism as an ideal, if you accept that the capitalist system really isn't working or isn't working well, then how do you resist the Marxist option? How do you resist the conclusion? Well, really, the next natural stage in development would be a dictatorship of the proletariat working itself out toward the eventual classless society. But, I mean, all of that sounds like nonsense today. It just sounds absolutely ridiculous. But there was a time when large numbers of intellectuals bought into it, when a very large number of intellectuals like yourselves felt, and this was indeed at the end of the Second World War, there was kind of an orthodox view in the middle decades, that really, of the 20th century, you're forced to choose. You can choose fascism, which has been discredited, or you can choose some version of Marxism. You can choose some kind of socialism, communism. There isn't any alternative between capitalist fascism of the Mussolini, Hitler variety, and some sort of a collectivist society of the Stalinist variety. And the idea that there might be an alternative way was supposed to have been discredited by the great economic crisis of the 1930s, by the great crash beginning in 1929 and really extending through the war. All of that now seems totally obsolete. I don't know anybody who believes that anymore, but a large number of professional intellectuals thought the days of the capitalist, the days when there could be a free liberal capitalist society, those are gone. It's either going to gravitate to fascism, or it will collapse of its own economic instability, and you will have some sort of communism emerge. This is why, incidentally, Hayek was a kind of breath of fresh air, though many of his actual claims are exaggerated, and indeed, I don't want to say preposterous, but they're certainly implausible, let me put it that way. He argued that, in fact, if you try to achieve democratic socialism by making the sorts of welfare state institutions that have been effected in the United States and Britain, if you try to do that, eventually it leads to the gulag. Eventually it leads to some kind of communist totalitarianism. The famous book is called The Road to Serfdom. And I don't want to parody it, but it had an exaggerated claim, and the claim was that essentially the effort to mess around with capitalism by instituting various forms of social institutions which would ameliorate the unjust effects of capitalism, that would inevitably lead to some form of totalitarianism. Now, I don't think Hayek was right, but I think he was right to point out that you don't get social democracy without a price, social democracy inherently leads to a certain kind of bureaucratization, and that you're victims of the massive bureaucracies. If you've ever tried to get a car through the customs, or you've ever had a hassle with the immigration, you realize the sheer inertial totalitarian force of the bureaucracy. And I don't know what it's like to be a foreigner in this country, but I've been a foreigner in other countries, and it can be a tremendous hassle. In England, it always seemed to work out for me because I can talk upper-class English talk. And so in the end, they leave me alone. They say, "You really want to go to Oxford, do you, sir?" And then I say, "Yeah, I'm invited. I'm on sabbatical." "Oh, are you indeed?" And then I haul out these letters in this snobby Englishy prose. "John, we do look forward to having you in Christchurch," and all that sort of thing. And I show them the letter, and they quit hassling me. Okay. But I think bureaucracies are horrible things to deal with because the bureaucrats get a kind of authority that extends beyond the intentions of the creation of the institution that ever set them up. They think their power extends beyond the status function of a GS-13. So I think Hayek was right about something, namely there is a constricting element in the sheer bureaucratization of modern society. And he's wrong to think it leads to a concentration camp, but it certainly does not. It doesn't facilitate the free and independent expression of the human spirit by any means. And you are more trapped into a system of the kind of system that Foucault called biopower than you're likely to be aware of. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about this today. Now I want to go on and continue the discussion of human rights, which is a good test case for my theory of society. On my theory, all rights are status functions. And if something is a status function, then the apparatus that I've described should come into play, and we have to ask, how is that supposed to work for universal human rights? Okay, now, but before I launch into that, any questions about socialism and the class differences and all that kind of stuff? Does anybody want to say anything about that or any questions about that? All right, well, let's go on then to human rights. All rights are status functions. Why? Well, a right is a deontic power that has to arise from certain types of recognition. And it's only going to function, it's only going to work if there is some sort of collective intentionality that recognizes your right. Most rights that one can think of are within institutions. So, for example, as a possessor of these bits of paper, I have the right to do something with debts. Yeah, to take care of my debts, public and private, because it says on it, it's legal tender for all debts, public and private. So this gives me a certain set of deontic powers. It gives me rights. As a holder of a valid California driver's license, I won't show off everything in my wallet, but I do have one of those. I also have certain rights in the state of California. But now somebody, and I think, as I said, that I think it was in the 17th century, but it really blossomed in the 18th century, got the wild idea that you have a whole inventory of rights just by being a human being. And these are called universal human rights. And it's a fantastic idea. And it proved to be enormously powerful and enormously liberating in things like the French Revolution and the American Revolution. But we have to ask, what are these rights, and where do they come from, and why should we recognize them anyway? Why should we care about these universal human rights? Now, various people have pointed out to me, well, it's not really invented in the 18th century, that in fact the Spaniards, the Spanish theologians, recognized that the natives in the New World had rights. It's true that the actual conquistadores didn't pay much attention to their rights, but the priests back in Spain thought these are all children of God and they have as much rights as anybody else. I don't think that is the same as a universal human right. You see, you could argue, well, the Ten Commandments gives you certain rights. It says, honor thy parents, or thou shalt not kill, so I have a right not to be killed, and if I'm a parent, I have a right to be honored. The whole atmosphere of that is totally different from universal human rights. This is a set of commandments, of directives, handed down by God. And the idea that we're all equal under God is not the same as the Enlightenment idea that there is an inventory of universal human rights which we all possess. What's the difference? Well, in the inventory of human rights, there is a certain conception of human nature, and I think that is going to be essential to the notion of a human right. Okay, so let's at least at the start say what is special about human rights is that they are universal. They apply to everybody. They're equal. Everybody's supposed to have equal rights. And in some sense that we need to explain, they're supposed to be natural. Natural, universal, and equal. And natural, I think, must mean having something to do with your nature as a human being. Now, it's become unfashionable in political theory to talk about human nature, but I think you can't make sense out of political theory, and indeed you can't make sense out of the notion of a human right without some kind of a conception of human nature. And I'll get to that in a few moments when we start to give a list, when we start to give an inventory of what are human rights. The important thing to see first, though, is that there is a logical constraint on the attribution of rights, namely the force, the deontic force of saying that you have a right is always that the right is against somebody. Whenever you have a right, there must be somebody who is thereby under an obligation to you. So if you're my next-door neighbor and I have what is called a right of easement over your driveway, then that means I have a right to drive my car across your driveway in order to get into my garage. And that means, now this is the cash value, you are under an obligation not to interfere. So whenever you say X has a right, let's write this part down. X has R, X does A. This is a right to do something. That implies Y has an obligation, and we'll just abbreviate that as O. Right has Y has O. Y not interfere with X does A. And I think this is a general logical constraint on the attribution of rights. Whenever you have a right to do something, there has to be somebody that the right is against. There has to be some Y that has an obligation not interfering with you doing the thing you have a right to do. If you look closely at what is called the Bill of Rights, you see that most of our rights are, strictly speaking, against the federal government. So the First Amendment says, Congress shall pass no law restricting the freedom of speech. That means your right to free speech initially is against Congress. Now, the courts have extended that so that not just Congress, but no local jurisdiction can pass a law restricting free speech. They've extended the notion. But the idea is that whenever you have a right, such as the right to free speech, there must be somebody who has an obligation not to interfere with your doing something. And the logical peculiarity of universal human rights is that everybody is under an obligation. So if you have a universal right to free speech, as I think you do, then that implies that everybody is under an obligation not to interfere with the exercise of free speech. Now, that is a remarkable claim, and I think it's that logical feature that shocks people like Bentham and McIntyre. Remember last time I quoted these wonderful passages from Jeremy Bentham, where he says this is a lot of nonsense to talk this way because any right must be within a system of laws. You can't have a system of universal human rights. You have to have rights guaranteed by actual laws within actual institutions, such as the rights of parents or the rights of property owners or the rights of car drivers or whatever it might be. But you can't have these universal human rights. It makes no sense. Genuine rights have to be within system of laws. But I don't think that can be correct. I think there are lots of rights that we have that, quite apart from universal human rights, there are all sorts of rights that are not part of a system. They're not recognized by the law. I give an example in the book, but I'm sure you can think of better examples. I think if you're married, then if you want to undertake some major shift in your life, I wanted to quit working for the University of California and become a blackjack dealer in Las Vegas, my wife has a right to be consulted about that. It doesn't say that in the law anywhere. There's no law. But I think within families, there are all sorts of rights that are not officially recognized by the laws. So I don't think we want to say that it has to be the case that any right must be legally recognized or it ceases. It can't be a right. I think there are lots of rights that are not legally recognized. Legal recognition gives a kind of official institutional structure to a right, but it's not logically necessary for the existence of the right. But what are we going to say then about universal human rights? Well, there are a couple of things, it seems to me, we need to say. One is, formally speaking, there's nothing puzzling about there being a status function that applies to you in virtue of being a human being. So if you just have the formula, X counts as Y, and Y has status function SF, then there's nothing in that formula that prevents the Y term from being human being. So in virtue of your biological makeup, you count as a human being, and as a human being, you have a status which gives you the functions of being a possessor of universal human rights. There's nothing logically odd about the formula that creates universal human rights. What is puzzling, and this is the puzzle we now have to answer, what is puzzling is, well, what are they, and why these and not some others? See, then what we normally think of as rights derive from the institution within which they are rights. So, for example, right now we're in the institution of a university, and as such I have certain rights as the instructor in charge of the course, and you have certain rights as students. And then correspondingly we have all sorts of obligations and duties and requirements and authorizations. We have the whole apparatus of status functions. One of the ridiculous thing about the dreadful 60s was that all of that was challenged. A lot of otherwise intelligent students would say, well, okay, but why the hell should you give the lecture? Why don't I give the lecture or something like that? And, you know, I'm perfectly happy to explain this, but it's not an intelligent use of my time. The answer I gave was always the same, because there's an imbalance in the amount of knowledge that you and I possess, and I'm trying to alter that imbalance in your favor. I'm trying to raise your level of knowledge to a higher level. But the fact that I had to do this was a part of the general idiocy, where the normal background assumptions about the structure of institutions was constantly being challenged. But the point for the present discussion is, granted that there's nothing formally wrong, that this is being a human being can be a status like any other status, and with a status can have status functions. What are they? The other status functions derive from the nature of the institution. My rights as a property owner, my rights as a car driver are tied to what it is what it is to have an institution of private property or an institution of authorized driving in the state of California or in other jurisdictions. What is the corresponding institutional features of being a human being that gives you some things as rights and not others? Now, that's the real challenge of justifying human rights, and I think Jeremy Bentham thought that question couldn't be answered. However, I want to suggest an answer to it, and that is this. I think you can't justify human rights without some kind of a theory, some kind of an account of what it is to be a human being, what's special about being a human being. And then I think if you get to things like, well, why should we have free speech? Why should there be a universal right to free speech? And again, it's a mistake that Americans make to think, well, you just cite the Constitution, and that's that. The reason we have free speech is it's guaranteed by the First Amendment. No, as philosophers, that's not good enough for us. We have to say, why that? Why the right to free speech? And I think there's an answer to that, but it's contentious. Here's how it goes. We are speech act performing animals. It's in our nature to express ourselves as much as it's in our nature to be able to move around or breathe or wave our arms around or eat or reproduce. We are speech act performing animals, and we cannot flourish without expressing ourselves. Part of flourishing as a human being involves the capacity to express yourself. Now, that's not going to be sufficient to say that, that our nature as human beings requires that we express ourselves in order to flourish, because there are lots of other things in our nature as human beings that I don't think we have a right to do. Anybody who observes adolescent boys discover that it seems to be in their nature to want to beat up on other adolescent boys, presumably over their fantasies about adolescent girls. But I won't speculate on the motives, but the fact is, males like to beat up on other males. Is there a universal human right? I don't think so. I think, yes, it is in the nature of males to be more aggressive than females. I won't go into the sociobiological reasons for that, but it doesn't mean that there is a special right to do that. What's the difference between free speech and beating up on other guys? And the difference has to come with let's put it in grand continental-sounding terms, has to come with an axiology. We have to have a set of values. We have to think some things are more valuable than others. And I don't think you can do a theory of human rights without both of those features. You have to have a theory of human nature, and you have to have a theory about what's valuable in human life. And now, it's not arbitrary. I can give you reasons why I think a free expression is valuable. But you can't justify freedom of speech without a notion of what is valuable in addition to what is natural. So the account that I'm going to give you makes two important philosophical claims. One is there's no justification for human rights without a theory of human nature, and there's no justification for selecting specific features of human rights without a theory of what's valuable in human life. You see, there are a lot of interesting things about human nature that we don't fully understand. I think a lot of people have the impression that if it weren't for the restrictions of the law, males would be raping females all the time. Because in general, the males, or at least in a lot of cases, I know the males are bigger and stronger than the females. But if you look at primates, rape is rare among primates. Apparently, the males want more than just physically overcoming resistance. So I think, there are these interesting facts. When you get in a military situation where the normal rules are off, and you have not just a stronger males, but militarily armed males, some armies rape and others don't. Why don't the Americans rape? They don't. The Russians raped their way across Europe. When they got to Berlin, 9 months later, there were literally 100,000 babies born in the hospitals of Berlin. Well, if you do the arithmetic, that means you got to have an awful lot of rapes to get 100,000 babies. And that was regarded as perfectly normal. I think it was not. I don't think it was as much sexual as it was political. And if you like, a question of vengeance. They wanted revenge for what had happened inside Russia, and so they and their authorities let them get away with this. But in the American Army and the British Army, that didn't happen. Nothing like that happened. So it isn't just a matter of what's more powerful and what isn't. And there's a woman who's a friend of mine who's written a book about this. Her name is Isabelle Delpois. She's French. And what she has done is study rape in Serbia and places like that. And it is often just politically motivated. Anyway, I'm digressing. The point I'm trying to make now is just having a biologically based inclination is not a sufficient ground for a human right. It is a necessary condition that you have to show that human nature flourishes under the condition that you have certain rights and not others, but you also have to show that the thing that you're giving, assigning a right to do has value, that it's a valuable thing. And I think that's the ground for the argument for the right to free speech. You need two elements for the justification of free speech. You need the recognition of the fact that we are speech act performing animals, and secondly, you need a claim that it's valuable what we do by way of performing speech acts. Now, I hope that all sounds platitudinous to you, but it runs dead counter to the tradition. The tradition in John Stuart Mill, the utilitarian tradition, says we have free speech on utilitarian grounds. If we have a better society, we flourish more if we have a free expression, the free marketplace of ideas. But I think there are lots of cases where the free marketplace of ideas doesn't work, and there's all kinds of speech which is stupid, vicious, nasty, racist, authoritarian, and so on, and all sorts of utilitarian disadvantages. All the same, you have a right to free speech, to say things that are stupid, racist, vicious, etc. You see, the feminists argue, or at least some feminists argued, that, well, look, speech is an act like any other. Actually, there are guys who write books called speech acts, and those show that speech is an action like any other. Now, why the hell shouldn't speech be regulated like any other act? And the answer I want to give to that is two. One is speech acts derive especially from our nature. We are speech act performing animals. And secondly, that it's valuable. What we do by way of expressing ourselves is valuable. And the answer that they give to that is, yeah, but how about cases where it's not valuable, where it's really hurtful, where it really damages people? And I respect that sentiment. I think we have to take those cases seriously. But there is a difference between speech acts and other kinds of acts. And that is, to use a piece of jargon here, the perlocutionary effects are up to you. If somebody says stupid things about me, and believe me, they often do, my feelings might be hurt, but it's up to me if I allow them to be hurt. The sticks and stones slogan of a school children comes into play here. I still survive unscathed if people express all kinds of negative opinions about me, and all I got to do is pick up the philosophy journals and you'll find all kinds of negative opinions. I'm sorry these guys have these idiotic articles that get published, but I grant you they have a right to do it. Okay, yes. Yeah.
You will be shut down.
That's right. No, this was a point I made last time about the background power. What I'm talking about now is to what extent society should recognize free speech. And that initially takes the form of a legal recognition. However, you make a deep point, and it follows up with something I said in an earlier lecture. Namely, there are all sorts of things that you have a right, all sorts of opinions that you have a right to hold, which in the societies I live in, you will be severely penalized if you express those opinions. And we would like to think that universities are exceptionally tolerant. They are not. On the contrary, they tend to be more intolerant than other institutions, particularly where, say, faculty and graduate students are concerned. I think as an undergraduate, you can probably get away with opinions that would be very costly to you if you held them as a faculty member or as a graduate student. Conformity is the norm, and people are seriously threatened if you hold views that are wildly at variance with the prevailing background norms. I happened to have been in a college in Oxford which was several hundred years out of date. It was the most aristocratic, corrupt institution I've ever been in, but it was immensely charming for that very reason. Nobody gave a damn what your opinions were. If I had said to my friends, look, I've decided I'm going to become a fascist, people would have said, oh, frightfully interesting. John's becoming a fascist. or if I said, I'm going to be a communist, same thing. And in my college, we had both fascists and communists, not just people you call fascists. That's something else. But the son of the head of the British Fascist Party, His name was Oswald Mosley, his father. Anyway, his son Michael was a guy I knew in college. Of course, he was a fascist. He was a fascist the way many of you are Democrats. Nobody got excited about it. And similarly, with communists, there were lots of communists. Now, Americans, partly because of democratic society, are more insecure. They're more deeply threatened if you hold a view that's at variance with their views. And when I have found that often faculty members are shocked when they discover what I think about such and such a question, and they feel somehow threatened by it in a way that they wouldn't be threatened if an undergraduate held those views. So I think you're absolutely right about that. And the point I tried to make was there's a form of power that I call background power, and the constraint, the directive is conform. You're supposed to conform, the sanctions are all kinds of informal social sanctions. You don't get arrested, but if I decided to become a fascist tomorrow and announce it publicly and give a lot of fascist lectures and so on, you will find that there will be all sorts of sanctions imposed on me. Sometimes people get very insecure. And there was a period when I don't know what the legal status was, but it was very hard legally even to be a member of the Communist Party. I mean, just ignorant about that period. But was it legally? I knew a lot of communists. I mean, was it illegal?
Yeah, but you couldn't be at Berkeley and be a communist.
You couldn't be employed as a professor in Berkeley as a communist. Yeah, you could not. That's true. So there were legal constraints.
Yeah.
You didn't go to jail, but you didn't get tenure either. Yeah, so you had there were all these informal constraints, and these are kind of shameful periods where that people pay lip service to freedom of speech and freedom of opinion, but they don't really believe it. Okay, other questions? Yeah. 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 I see, yeah. Well, the military is special because they have an overriding constraint, combat efficiency. It's a matter of life and death. And you have to ask yourself always when you think about what should be the rule in the military, ask yourself, is it going to increase or decrease the probability that these guys are going to die in combat? So I think that a lot of human rights are seriously restricted in the military. Free speech, for example, is very seriously restricted. You can't publish an article saying that the commanding officer is an idiot. You get real trouble if you do that. Yes.
During World War I, the Alien and Sedition Act actually allowed the government to throw people in jail for criticizing.
Yeah, that was in the Alien and Seditions Act. What was the date of that? Was it? Well, wasn't there an earlier one right after the founding of the country? Here I'm just ignorant. I wouldn't pass the high school history exam on this one. We'd have to look it up. But I know that normally in wartime, people get more insecure, and they become more insecure about any kind of nonconformity. In the First World War, there was a great deal of insecurity of precisely this kind. Okay, so I'm suggesting now you can justify human rights. Formally, it's no different from any other status function. When it comes to making an inventory of human rights, you need two things. You need a theory of human nature and a set of values. But now comes an interesting recent development. If you go look at the rights of man in the French Revolution, or you look at the First Amendment to the United States, it seems to me, without exception, the rights that are listed are what I call negative rights, like the right to free speech or the right to freedom of religion or the right to move about freely. All of those are negative rights in that they satisfy this condition that Y is under obligation not to interfere with my doing something. But by 1945, there had grown a movement for what I will call positive rights, where it's not enough, your right is not enough to be left alone, but other people actually have to do something to enable you to do what you want to do. See, for free speech, all I have to do is be left alone. But if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I think they haven't really thought it through. Because they give a list of things that includes positive rights where everybody would have to make really quite expensive contributions in order to facilitate these rights. And I read you one last time. I can't resist reading it again, but you can download this thing. It takes about 30 seconds. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Article 25, one of my favorites, says everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, necessary social services, the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood and circumstances beyond his control. Now, that is a hell of a document, if you think about that. What that says is not everybody is under an obligation not to interfere with, but everybody is under an obligation Y enables. You have to enable this. Y has an obligation. Y enables. X does A. And I think you can't justify that except for a very small number of rights. Let me immediately make three qualifications. First of all, if a given institution, say the state of California, wants to say everybody in the state of California has a right to adequate housing, that seems to me a legitimate exercise of an institutional power. But that's not what this says. This says, as a matter of being a human being, everybody has a right to, and then follows that list. But that would imply that all of us are under an obligation to provide adequate housing for every resident of the Amazon basin. They all have to have decent two-level houses with air conditioning because otherwise they wouldn't be having adequate housing. And I don't think I can justify that. That is, I don't think I can justify the positive rights. But there'd be three qualifications to that. There's no objection to specific institutions enacting these. If a specific institution like the state of California wants to enact that, that seems to me perfectly okay. The second thing is what I think they mean, or maybe what they intend is, they're not serious about rights. They mean, wouldn't it be nice if everybody had an adequate housing and good medical care? But of course, that's not it. The right is a deontic power. It poses an obligation on everybody. And what we're talking about now is not what would be a desirable society, but rather what actual powers should be created applying to every human being. And I think you can't justify these things. The third qualification I want to make is this. If you say not everybody has a right to adequate housing, but if you say everybody has a right to seek adequate housing, well, then it becomes a negative right. Then it seems to me perfectly legitimate. So my objection is to claiming that there are universal status functions of a positive kind, that there are universal status functions such as that we all have a right to an adequate standard of living. I don't think we do. I don't think that given the fact that we now have, how many billion people are there on Earth, that we're in a position where all of us are under an obligation to provide an adequate standard of living for all of the other 6 or 7 billion people. Okay, so that's, I think you can't make the justification for positive rights. You can make the justification for negative rights. Which ones? Well, we're all professional philosophers. Let's give a list of what are universal human rights. If we had to have a list of universal human rights, what would they be? Well, I think, first of all, everybody has a right to life and safety, meaning everybody's under an obligation not to kill anybody else or to endanger the safety of anybody else. So life and safety. I'm including safety here as or life as part of safety. You have a right not to be assaulted are shot or beat up by other people. And that's, again, that's a negative right. It just means left alone. Secondly, it seems to me you have a right to personal property. The clothing that you wear, the car you drive, the house you own, you have a right to have that kind of personal property. How far does it go? Suppose you own a whole string of factories or a 500,000 acres of property in the Central Valley. Well, that seems to me those are matters of public policy. What counts as personal? And this is why I put personal here, because I think human flourishing, the kind I was talking about, requires a certain kind of mindness. This belongs to me. It's my shirt, my car, my house. So you have a right to safety and a right to personal property. And then comes the one that's been my favorite, and that is free speech. You have a right, by free speech here, I mean short for free expression. You have a right to think, state, write, and publish anything you want. And indeed, I think the internet is an empowering device here. There's an awful lot of trash on the internet. I am not myself on something called Facebook, but many of you have seen it. And every time I've seen it, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, because it's sort of, it facilitates a certain kind of a self-aggrandizing lie. Every time I look at people I know who write on Facebook, it's not exactly a flat lie, but it sort of makes them appear in a really good light. I'm not saying that this is always well exercised, but I think you do have a right to free speech. Well, let me just get my list out, and then we can talk about extending it or contracting it. I think coordinate with that, you have a right to your own beliefs and opinions. You don't have to conform to other people. And one of the things I liked about the current president of the United States, in his inaugural lecture, he made explicit reference to the right of atheism, the right to have no religion at all. In general, presidents of the United States are scared to death to say anything like that. It might sound communist or something, you know. And so you're a right to belief and opinion, and I want to say including atheism, but you can add that yourself. Okay. Now, some others that have not been so widely recognized. I can't imagine my life without the right to travel freely around the world. I think that's a basic human right, the right to travel. Granted that it's sometimes infringed in wartime and stuff like that, but basically the right to travel is a basic human right. And I think the right to privacy is a basic human right. I need to be left alone in certain crucial areas of my life. And I run with rather a short list here. The right to hang out with the kind of people I want to hang out with. The right of free association, we can call that. However, it's a kind of minimal list. That's sort of the best I can do on my... I'm going to take questions in a minute, but let me just summarize what I've said so far. What I've said is, if we're going to justify human rights, there are two conditions we have to meet. You have to have a certain connection, a certain conception of what human life is, and you have to have a certain set of values about human life. And this does not include any positive rights. Now, are there any? Well, let's get to that in a minute. Right now, we're just talking about negative rights. And this is the list I come up with. You have a right to life and safety, personal property, free speech, belief and opinion, travel, privacy, and free association. It's not a very big list, but those seem to me to be basic negative human rights. Okay, there were a lot of hands up. Questions? You had a question at the back, yeah. 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 Well, I think that's probably right. What I'm nervous about with education, but let's add it here, is how far do you want to go? That is, does it extend to postdocs? Is it a universal human right to educate, to have education up to what level? I think everybody has a right to learn how to read and write, okay? And that looks like it's a positive right, because it looks like you got to take some positive effort to give people the wherewithal to learn how to read and write. Okay, so let's put education how far and what nature. Yeah, I'm uncomfortable with it because I want to say it's a matter of public policy and not a matter of right. But anyway, go ahead.
Food.
Yeah, well, the right to eat. Well, are we under an obligation? Now, are we under an obligation to provide food to everybody in the world? I don't think so.
Negative rights.
Yeah, negative rights. Okay. But then what does it mean to say the right to seek food? Okay, that's a negative right. The right to seek education, but I thought in both cases something stronger than that was meant. The right to seek education, that's just the right of part of the right of association and free expression. But if you're saying, when you say everybody has a right to education, I think you mean they have a right to an institutional structure that provides the education. That's a positive right. And I'm not convinced that everybody has a positive right to be fed by everybody else. Now, there's an interesting thing that happened. One thing that seemed mathematically certain was Malthus. Malthus showed that human beings reproduced at a rate that was not just arithmetical by addition, but it was more geometrical by multiplication, and that eventually the supply of food wouldn't keep up because the food supply just increases by increases in efficiency and increases in the amount of land, but it doesn't multiply in a way that human beings multiply when they reproduce. And everybody thought, well, okay, we're gonna reach a stage of a famine or near universal famine. It didn't happen. If there is a famine somewhere in the world today, you know that it's engineered. You know that it's deliberately created for political reasons. Why didn't it happen? Well, to put it in an oversimplified fashion, some people we never heard of in Iowa, guys you couldn't name them to save your life, invented something called the Green Revolution. And they just made it possible to produce crops at a vastly greater rate. Now, eventually, the population will catch up. But those guys in Iowa gave us a few hundred years ahead of Malthus because we can now produce enough food to feed everybody in the world. Now, there's enough food resources to feed absolutely everybody. That won't go on forever if we keep growing. The current estimate is that we're going to stop growing at about 9 billion. Why? Well, I think the theory is people are going to get smarter. And what we've discovered is when women get educated, they have smaller families. They have fewer children. So the unlimited population growth is in large part a function of ignorance. And as that is overcome, that will decline. We'll have a decline. We'll have a leveling off, a stabilizing in the population at about 9 billion people. I'm not sure that I'm confident of that, but that's the prevailing opinion now, as it won't go on forever. Okay, but in any case, the Malthus didn't pan out because of the revolution in agriculture. Now, there's some other hands up. You and then you. First you.
Yeah. So it seems like maybe those.
No, I think Mill's list wasn't wrong. What was wrong was the philosophy. And I might as well tell you why. If you think the justification for free speech is utilitarian, it makes us better off that we have free speech, then there would be no free speech for cases where we plainly are not better off. And Mill has only a couple of things to say about those, and they're not very plausible. One is, well, the truth will lose its gutsiness unless it's in the free marketplace of ideas with all its falsehood. Yeah, but how about the cases where it doesn't lose its gutsiness and the falsehood just gets in the way of the truth. There's all kinds of falsehood running around. And it doesn't seem to me that I need all this falsehood. I mean, do I really need a whole lot of creationists running around trying to get control of the schools in order that I can truly appreciate the deep truth in Darwin? I doubt it. I mean, would my conviction of evolutionary theory be diminished if all the creationists shut up? I don't think that it would be diminished. So I think that's a poor argument. And then the other argument, there are other arguments that the utilitarians use is, well, as an epistemic argument, you can't really tell which views are going to be bad and have a bad effect. Yeah, you can't, but let's just postulate about cases where you can tell that they're going to have bad. I mean, racist or sexist views are going to have bad consequences. Let's suppose we just give that. Does somebody still have a right to express them? And I want to say, yes, they do. They still have a right, even in cases where there's a utilitarian disadvantage. Now, there's a persistent mistake that people make, and it's a kind of pun. They think, if you have a right to do something, then it's all right to do it. It doesn't follow from the fact that I have a right to free speech, that therefore it's okay to say things that are stupid, vicious, hateful, or otherwise nasty. No, it's not okay. It's wrong. But I have a right to do things even though they're wrong. Having a right does not imply that it's right, that it's the right thing to do. You'd be surprised how often that mistake is made. In the 60s, that dreadful era, a lot of professors, well, not a lot, but some professors said, well, of course it's right for me to indoctrinate my students with my political views because academic freedom gives me the right to do it. Now, academic freedom gives you the right to say anything you want in your classroom, but it doesn't make it a right thing to do. It doesn't. Stupidity is never the right thing to do, even though you have a right to be stupid. It's hard for people to get that point. Maybe it's just a pun on the word right. But X has a right to do Y does not mean it's okay for X to do Y. Okay, you're next. And then you and then you. Yeah. Oh, Jennifer, she's been, I think, well, you first and then Jennifer. Okay. Yeah, you're next. Okay. Now, here is another. The question was, well, how about the case where do these rights extend to everyone? If I'm a prisoner, a convicted felon, do I have a right to publish a prison newspaper in which I denounce the prison authorities? Or do I have a right to make speeches in the prison yard? And, of course, any right can conflict with other rights and can conflict with other requirements. And there are all kinds of situations where you do not have a right to free speech. There is a sense in which you do not have the right to free speech in this classroom. You only have a right to talk when I call on you, but you can't get up and make a speech on your own. And this is a case where your right is restricted because of some institutional structure. A prison and an army are special cases, but they're not. The principle is the same, that any right, any status function can conflict with other status functions. And this, again, is a source of a lot of mistakes, which I'll get to. Jennifer, you're next.
It strikes me that human rights, this whole theory of human rights, is linguistically constructed.
Yeah.
And the theory is based on what we find valuable
In human life.
In human life, we're speech act performing animals.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of them are. Yeah.
The
bees do. Those are speech acts.
No, actually, the bees not. As much as, I mean, I think it would be hard to argue that. But,
yeah. Well, the bees I know have speech acts.
And then they're linguistically enculturated animals, dolphins, certainly, higher-level primates. At what point do we want to say that your list also applies to animals?
Well, okay. This is another question that I have avoided talking about. If there are human rights, are there not animal rights? And I have to say, I think there are animal rights, and I try as hard as I can not to think about it. Why? Because I'm deeply suspect I'd have to become a vegetarian, and I don't want to be a vegetarian, not yet. I mean, you remember St. Augustine said in his prayer to God, "God, give me chastity, but not yet." And this is a bit how I feel about animal rights. Give me a theory of animal rights, but not yet, because I'd have to give up. Yeah, the dinner that I'm looking forward to would no longer be available. I'm dining at Chez Panisse tonight, and I will not eat the vegetarian menu. However, to speak seriously, I think you're absolutely right, of course. Animals are sentient beings. They have a right not to suffer. And what are the extent of their rights? Do they have a right to free speech? Well, I don't know how we would restrict their right to free speech if we wanted to, because we don't know what they're saying. Okay, so, yeah.
We do. I mean, I'm wondering about the moral implications of this as applied to linguistically enculturated animals that
yeah.
are kept in parks and,
yeah.
and labs now, and they are trained. And we do know what dolphins, we can communicate. So it strikes me now that they are at least starting to move into the category
yeah.
of having rights,
yeah.
and they're killed or they're treated pretty badly. And
yeah. Well, I got enough problems already. Do I have to give dolphins the right to vote? And I mean, at least some kind of representation in Congress, even if they are not able to perform certain kinds of speech acts.
No, but how about the right to travel?
Yeah, sure travel like freely. I mean, we keep them locked up, and I'm just not sure how much. I mean, the city of Berkeley is wonderful in its political correctness. You're no longer the owner of your dog. You're the caretaker of your dog. But that's got everything back to front. He takes care of me. I'm his owner. That's why he's paid to take care of me. But in any case, there is. We have not got an intellectual grip on the status of animals. And for a long time, people would rather not think about it. And I think we're going to have to start thinking about it. So vegetarianism, here I come, I guess. But not, as I said earlier, not yet. First, I got to have more hamburgers. Well, something better than hamburgers. But anyway, other hands were up. You had a hand up. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that at a certain point, then you have to wonder, because then is the lion violating the gazelle's right?
Yeah. Okay, that's the other thing. You see, what I think a lot of humanistic people lament is carnivorousness. Because the same person who is a vegetarian will typically own a cat, and cats you can't make a vegetarian cat. I have had dogs. You have vegetarian cats?
No,
you can't. You got to give them meat. And this is just a fact about evolution: is that some animals are going to have to kill other animals in order to survive. And I don't want to have to settle the issue today. What is the right distribution of death among carnivorous and non-carnivorous animals? One of the things is, I mean, America, as H.L. Mencken said, when his friend said to him, well, how come you don't come with us to Europe? And he said, I wouldn't leave this place for anything. It's a free zoo. I mean, all you got to do is pick up the newspapers. And one of the things that's going on in the newspapers that's hilarious is that the wolves are being reintroduced into... Wyoming and North Dakota. The wolves are being reintroduced as a sort of a part of, I mean, it's part of their right, I guess, as wolves to go back and hang out where they used to live. The problem is then they kill cattle and sheep and all the rest of it. I grew up in that part of the world, and the idea that somehow the wolves might have a right to run freely, where's my rifle? I mean, this is what every American boy in Wyoming thinks. No, we got to keep them down. So there are all these arguments going on. All right, I want to pursue this, though. Now, I made a strong claim. This is my list. I am not convinced that education and food belong on this list, but we're going to consider them. And the question now is, well, one of the questions is, what about positive rights? Are there any positive rights? And the only one I can think of that I'm really convinced of is that if you desperately need help, you have a right to help. I mean, for example, you're hit by a car in the street. Then I think you have there is a universal right. Anybody is under an obligation to help you if your life is at stake. So that's my one positive right. This is my up to seven. Here is my list of negative rights. Now, there were other hands up. Yes?
Well, if you have an obligation to help people when they're dying,
yeah.
How far does that go?
Okay, that's a very good question. I've even thought of that and have an answer to it. And roughly speaking, it's, so to speak, within convenient reach. So if a child is hit by a car in front of my house, I can't say, well, it's somebody else's kid. No, I can't. I have a moral obligation to recognize the right to life of this person. But if a child is hit by a car in Pretoria, South Africa, I'm not under an obligation. It's just not, it's not in the scope of my available action. Now, give me a philosophical justification of that. Well, I haven't got it yet. I've got an intuition. My intuition says the universal right to be helped in case of immediate need. You become helpless. You're an infant, or you are injured by an accident, or you become, you suddenly are suffering a stroke. You have a universal right to be helped. But now, why doesn't that extend then? Why don't I have other people? Everybody has an obligation to help me. But when, why doesn't everybody have an obligation to donate money to whoever it is that helps people in South Africa? Yes.
Well, I was thinking more of the harder, the tougher cases, like if you see someone being attacked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. No, that raises another thing. And this is the other question here, and that is all of these things raise conflicts. And the question is, of course, I have an obligation to help the child who is been hit by a car. But do I have an obligation to help a girl who is being raped by a large gang of thugs who have threatened to kill me if I don't get the hell out of there? And now that seems to me to raise conflicting obligations. And indeed, I have a right to consider my own interests up to a point. So I don't know. I doubt if there's an algorithm for answering questions like that. Now, one of the things that people do not understand, and this goes back to somebody else's question, is the fact that there are conflicts of rights and that you adjudicate the conflict often on utilitarian grounds does not show that the question was utilitarian in the first place. We often restrict your right to free speech on utilitarian grounds. If there's a clear and present danger, as the lawyers used to say, you know, the famous example about, what was it, you're shouting theater in a crowded firehouse. Yes, right. You mustn't go into a crowded firehouse and shout theater. I got so sick of that example that I couldn't resist producing this variation on it. The cases like that show that utilitarian consideration can override basic and universal human rights. Now, that people think, well, that shows that you didn't have an absolute right, or that the right was really utilitarian to start with. It doesn't show that. The right does not become less absolute by the fact that it can be in conflict with other rights and other sorts of considerations. And a right does not become a utilitarian right on the fact that it can be overridden on utilitarian grounds. I think we may have run out of time. I think somebody is trying to tell us something. I actually have one of these damn things. I don't know how it works, but it seems, it does tell the time. I can tell you that, and I may be accurate. We have to stop. We'll go on with this on Tuesday.